Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
How to get to Sesame Street. For Americans of almost every age, the question brings a flood of memories. Folks in their 50s and 60s raised their children on the show, and many Americans in their 20s, 30s, and early 40s have had the experience of first watching it themselves as kids, then introducing the familiar characters and themes of Sesame Street to their own little ones. So how did Sesame Street come into existence? Why has it worked so well for so long? And is it fair to say that Big Bird and Elmo and Ernie and Bert have had a major impact not just on educational television, but on American culture? Television critic Michael Davis explores the show's unique and fascinating development in his new book, Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. Michael, welcome to Think.
Oh, Chris, thanks so much.
Sesame Street exists today in part because of that inescapable fact that TV can be mesmerizing for kids. Would you talk a little bit about its genesis?
Oh, sure. Mesmerizing is the word to describe the impetus for Sesame Street. There was a young girl, a three-year-old, named Sarah Morissette, who got up one Sunday morning at 6:30 to sit cross-legged in front of the family television set. It was about 1966. And she sat there watching the test pattern for 30 minutes, knowing that around 7 o'clock, cartoons would come on. Her father kind of got out of bed and saw this and just was so amazed at what was happening, and he wondered, what is it about television that would draw my daughter out of bed like this on a Sunday morning to watch nothing? Soon after that, he attended a dinner party, and the hosts of that dinner party were Joan Ganz Cooney and her husband Tim. It was in New York City, and after dinner, Lloyd told the story about Sarah and the test pattern, and he asked aloud, does anybody here think that television could do more than entertain children? Do you think television could teach? And that question that sort of hung in the air for a second was snatched by Joan Cooney, who said, you know, I don't know, but I'd really like to find out. And that's how Sesame Street began. It began with a question asked at a dinner party, and the two of them, Joan Cooney and Lloyd Morissette, were the co-founders of Children's Television Workshop. You remember that name?
Absolutely.
CTW. An amazing little nonprofit enterprise that they created in the late 1960s with $8 million, half of which came from the federal government, the other half from the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. $8 million is a lot of money back then.
Yeah, and one thing that has always set the show apart is that it's always been based in science. This wasn't just someone's idea of something. This was always vetted and tested according to the latest information about the way children learned.
Absolutely true. What set it apart from everything else is, number one, it was a children's show with a curriculum, with a bona fide curriculum. And number two, that curriculum was created with research and then tested afterwards with research to see if the ideas that they wanted to impart, if the concepts they wanted children to learn were actually in their brains after watching Sesame Street. And since that time, there has been a mound of research done on the program. It's the most researched show in the world, done by Sesame Workshop, which is now what CTW is called, and also independent research done on college campuses in the United States, Canada, and throughout the world.
We should step back for a minute, Michael, and talk about what else was on the television landscape for children in the late 60s and early 70s. This was at a time when not everyone even believed kids could learn much before they got to kindergarten at 5 or 6.
Oh, that's so, Chris. And, you know, the good thing, I guess, is that I'm old enough to remember it. I remember the nursery school era when, you know, children were sent off maybe one day a week or two, and we played and, you know, there was some music maybe, but very little was asked of us. And I think in the late 50s and the early 1960s, most people didn't give much thought to preschool education. But a revolution took place in the late 60s and the early 1970s, and suddenly we all realized that preschoolers could learn so much more and were ready for so much more. And Sesame Street kind of popped right at that moment, you know, when women were getting into the workplace in greater numbers and daycare centers were propagating and preschools were propagating as well, and so it sort of arrived at just the perfect moment. And as a result, within a couple of years, kindergarten teachers and first grade teachers were having to completely remake their lesson plans because children were arriving at school so much more prepared than they ever had been. They knew their alphabet. They knew some sight words. They knew how to count to 20 forwards and back. And that wasn't true before Sesame Street.
So for people who haven't seen the show in a while, and it seems to me that anybody who watched it as a kid remembers a lot of it really well because it does stick in your head. But what sort of mnemonic devices and what are the ways that Sesame Street communicates information without it seeming like a lesson?
All right. May I sing for a moment?
Yeah, I'd love
it. All right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10,
11, 12.
Okay.
Yeah.
What they did was they took what works for Madison Avenue, jingles, and the sort of the dynamic and mechanisms of commercials, and instead of selling beer or soap or breakfast cereal, they sold numbers and letters. A brilliant concept.
Brought to you by the letter Y and the number 13.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. And, you know, it was a wink-wink reference to the rest of television for the parents, but the children who, you know, they just thought the show was sponsored by the letter W or the number 9, you know?
Oh, and that's another great thing about Sesame Street is that it was always made with a second level, so that although it would work as a babysitter, there was an incentive for mom or for dad to sit there with their kids.
And that was deliberate, Chris. They were so smart in putting this show together. They realized that if they could hook in the caregiver, if mom or dad or the babysitter or grandma or whoever, the older sibling, would sit down and watch with the child, it was that much more likely that the child would walk away from the show with benefit. And what's interesting is that the longitudinal research done by Sesame Workshop proves that perfectly. It is true that kids learn so much more from television when an adult is around with them watching.
And the Sesame Street obviously taught letters and numbers and shapes and concepts like that. There was also this idea that people lived in what appeared to be a working class at best neighborhood, people of different ethnicities and obviously races lived all together. There was modeling not just for the kids, but also for their parents again.
Absolutely again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were determined to have a show that kind of reflected diversity and tolerance and acceptance. And it was for the kids as well as for the adults. And, you know, famously, the state of Mississippi refused to show Sesame Street in its early days not because the cast was integrated. It was more because the children on the show, who were basically neighborhood children, you know, black and white and Hispanic, all played together. That was seen as a dangerous notion by some people in Mississippi. So we're talking about a very different period in our cultural history, in American history. But yes, they were very keen on the idea of letting Sesame Street kind of project a very different vision of America. And in my 5 years of research on the book, I spoke to a lot of people who didn't grow up in an urban area. They grew up in, you know, rural America or, you know, places where they hardly could bring in television. And they all said, well, Gordon and Susan were the first black people I ever met. Maria was the first Hispanic woman I ever met. And they didn't actually meet them, of course, but Sesame Street was so real in the eyes of the beholder, they seemed like people we had met.
What was the original concept for using Jim Henson's Muppets? Because they weren't initially the stars that they are now.
No. You know, the truth is that they made pilot shows for Sesame Street in the summer of 1969, and some segments worked with little focus groups of preschoolers, but the segments that bombed were on the street with the actors that they had brought in to populate Sesame Street. At the time, there were no puppets on Sesame Street. It was just a bunch of adults, and the kids just hated it. And right around that time, John Stone, the now legendary executive producer of Sesame Street, suggested that he bring in his friend Jim Henson. He had worked with Jim on a special that was shot in Canada called Hey Cinderella. And the producers knew of Jim Henson, and they said, look, if we're going to have puppets on the show, we're going to have Jim Henson. And if we can't have Jim Henson, we aren't going to have puppets. And so that's how strongly they felt about him. And Jim looked at those early pilot episodes and said, you know, I don't see any reason why we can't have puppets interact with these you know, actors. There's no reason why not. And because the founding producers of Sesame Street had worked on Captain Kangaroo, they knew it was entirely possible to mix fantasy and reality because Captain Kangaroo spoke to Bunny Rabbit every day, and he spoke to Mr. Moose. So that's how it happened. That's what got it started. And Jim had, you know, doodles in his notebooks for years of this oversized bird puppet. They call it a walk-around puppet. And he saw this as his great opportunity to realize this character with Big Bird.
We should say that Captain Kangaroo was very jealous of the attention that was flooded into Sesame Street.
He was. And he was sore about the fact that so many people who had once worked for him ended up working for Sesame Street. But it wasn't like Joan Gans Cooney staged a raid on his talent. These men had already left the world of children's television and were lured back into it by the prospect of Sesame Street.
And the work environment there sounds really extraordinary from the very beginning. And you've written about Joan Gans Cooney's approach to managing the people that she hires.
Joan Gans Cooney is the rarest of birds. First of all, she's the most impressive public figure I've ever met. Secondly, she's the rare bird because she hired great people. She had a wonderful track record for hiring talent and the extraordinary ability to let the people do their job and step out of the way. You know, so often that's not the case. And Joan had enough belief in the people she hired and enough self-esteem for herself that she let them do their work. And that was a big key to the success of Sesame Street. She backed her people, and she let them do their work.
Now, not everything has worked over the years. There have been things that have sort of been tried and then pulled back. Can you talk about some of them?
Oh, yeah. Listen, characters have come and gone for good and bad reasons. And, you know, ideas for a season, you know, what they tackled with curriculum goals for a season didn't work or did work. But for the most part, the research team at Sesame Workshop and the writers tried to stay keenly aware of what was in the zeitgeist, what children needed, what current educational research was saying about them. So Sesame Street always changed.
Michael Davis is with us. He's a television critic whose new book is called Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. We'll be back to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is television critic Michael Davis. His new book is called Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. If you want to join us, our number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. There have been, over the years, as we alluded to before, some controversial characters. I wonder if you can talk about Matt Robinson and the creation of Roosevelt Franklin.
Oh, sure. Matt Robinson was the original Gordon, and he was hired by CTW to be a producer and writer, and that's what he wanted to be. But as they tried to cast Gordon, they had so many actors come through from New York, and each one of them was rejected. And John Stone, that executive producer, said, "You know, what we really need is somebody like Matt." And then everybody turned and looked at Matt, and he had a look on his face like, oh, no, not me. But they were able to talk him into it, and he was marvelous. He was a great Gordon, but he was really uncomfortable with the fame of it. He didn't mind doing the studio work, but when he went out onto the street, he was really not happy about being noticed. And, you know, like a lot of writers, he wanted to work in semi-obscurity. So there was another Gordon hire that didn't work out. And then finally came the wonderful Roscoe Orman, who's been around since the mid-70s. But, you know, Matt Robinson, while he was Gordon, created this fabulous character. And some of your listeners may remember Roosevelt Franklin. Roosevelt Franklin was a very sassy, very funny, very hip, and very urban contemporary character. There was no doubt that he had black sensibilities.
He was colored purple, right?
But... yes, magenta, actually.
Okay, magenta.
So, but, I mean, the way they wrote for him and the way that he was voiced, there was no question at all that not only was Roosevelt black, but all the kids at Roosevelt Franklin Elementary School were black as well. And people either loved him or were offended by him. And I don't think it was white people who were offended by him. It was sort of middle to upper class black people who thought that it sort of perpetuated the stereotype. And they leaned on Joan Ganz Cooney to get rid of the character, while other segments of the black community said, oh, come on, you know, he's great. But in the end, she did bend to the wishes of that first group, and Roosevelt Franklin disappeared, and I think it was a mistake. It was the first time that sort of political correctness seeped in to Sesame Street.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. What a pleasure. The two questions, I'm going to warn your producer, I'm going to sneak in an extra question because I thought of one. The number one, the DVDs of these early episodes came out a couple years ago with a very odd disclaimer, basically saying they're not for children. What an interesting, ironic thing to do. And the second question is, how did AIDS affect the children's television workshop in, say, the 1980s, early 90s? Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Well, okay. Yes, when Sesame Street Old School Volume 1 and Volume 2 came out, there was a disclaimer on it. And, you know, some people thought it was a little silly. But, you know, there were some things about the early episodes of Sesame Street that just wouldn't happen today. And I'll give you an example. In the opening film sequence that ran with the famous theme, there's a little girl sliding down a park slide, you know, aluminum park slide, and you see her underwear, and it's, you know, very visible. And back then, I think it was thought that that was cute. Today, you just wouldn't do that. Cookie Monster, when he was the character Alistair Cookie on Monster Peace Theater, right? Remember that?
Yeah.
He had a pipe in his mouth.
Oh, I forgot that.
He ate the pipe, but yes, he had a pipe in his mouth. So these were the kind of things that led the people at Sesame Workshop to suggest that, you know, maybe some of the things that we did in the late 60s and early 1970s aren't appropriate for today's audiences. But I think they went a little too far, and I think it didn't give enough credit to parents who can handle those situations and talk with their kids about it.
So if somebody picks these up at their own discretion, they're not going to probably damage their child for life if they
want to
flip them on.
In most cases, Chris, the children have been delighted to see the early episodes of Sesame Street. They're so good. And they hold up so beautifully.
And some of those little recorded segments are, I mean, I'm 38, and some of the same segments are still shown once in a while on Sesame Street.
Oh, yeah. You know, they dip into their library quite frequently, and I'm always so glad when they show a Bert and Ernie clip or they show a great Grover clip, because Grover, to me, is the greatest of all the Muppet teachers on Sesame Street. It seems to me that when Grover takes on a lesson plan, it really sticks. Do you remember near and far?
Oh, sure, when he's running and his little arms and legs are shaking all over. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, I think it's great that they can use their own archives. And they've done a beautiful job of updating their website, which is simply SesameStreet.com, and added so many video clips now. It's just a delight to visit their website.
And the other question from Ken, I believe it was about AIDS in the 80s. Was that a scourge through the staff?
Well, it did take the life of a brilliant puppeteer named Richard Hunt. And Richard was the great performer behind Forgetful Jones and Gladys the Diva Cow and the very frustrated composer Don Music. I hope some of these names are making your listeners smile a little bit. It was a great sadness when Richard passed, and there were some other incidences, you know, where people who were involved with Sesame Street did die from AIDS. But when they think about that period in our history, Richard always comes to mind because he was just so beloved.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Michael Davis is my guest. His new book is called Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. Next on the line from Fort Worth is Maggie. Hey, Maggie.
Hi. I was born in the 50s, and I remember asking my mother to teach me to read and write and being told, no, the school will teach you. And by the time I sat down in that little chair in first grade, it was such an intimidating process. I don't know if that contributed to some of the dyslexia, but my children grew up with Sesame Street. We read to them all the time. We underlined words, so they were picking it up. But I remember specifically the day when my 18-month-old did the call and response bit to the letter B, and that cracked the code. She doesn't remember learning to read. She doesn't remember learning to write. It's seamless, and it's wonderful.
That's a great story.
That's it.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Chris, may I make a prediction?
Sure.
We will have a lump in our throat from one caller, at least one caller. As people begin to tell you stories about Sesame Street, it's an amazing thing because it resonates in such a deep place, and the viewing experience is so intimate. I guarantee you somebody's going to call with something that's going to make us well up a little bit with tears.
Well, I remember, I think I was in college when the actor who played Mr. Hooper died, and I remember being really devastated about that.
Oh, yes. You know, that's the high water mark in the history of Sesame Street, I believe, the way that they dealt with the death of Will Lee, the actor, and Mr. Hooper, the character.
Because he didn't just disappear.
He didn't. And you know, in television, what happens when with an actor dies, they either replace him with another actor or they write him out of the script and say that, you know, he moved to Florida to be with his sister or something. But the producers and researchers at Sesame Street, they had too much respect for Will Lee to do that. And they decided to take on what was the thorniest of all questions for children, you know, the hardest thing to describe. And they brought together a wonderful consulting group of psychologists, psychiatrists, child development specialists, clergymen, and gave the writers what's called a curriculum bath. They immersed them in research. And from that, the writers go away, and they come up with scripts that are informed by the research, but also written in such a way that they're age-appropriate. And that's a very, very hard thing to do. Norman Stiles was the person who wrote the great script for that episode of Sesame Street when Mr. Hooper was memorialized, and you can find it on YouTube, and it is just one of the most beautiful things that the show ever attempted.
And a lot of the conflict in that episode is lived out through Big Bird, who, although he's always the largest one, is really, he's the, you know, the 3 or 4 or 5 year old,
yes,
in terms of his spirit.
Yes, he is the surrogate child, and he responds to the adult's explanation in the way that a child would, with first a kind of quizzical response, and then denial, and then a little anger, and then great sadness, and then finally acceptance.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Dylan in Dallas. Hello, Dylan.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Great,
I'm
you.
Actually going to go pick up this book here in a little bit. Quick question. I remember Sammy the Snake vividly to this day, and he scared the bejesus out of me when I was a kid. Whatever happened to him, did you get a lot of complaints? I mean, I've had great memories beyond that of Sesame Street. My 2-year-old daughter watches it. But I just remember that character so vividly.
You know, I don't know the answer to that one. I don't know if they received letters and calls, and, you know, it was one of those characters that they decided was not worth the risk anymore. You know, there were lots of examples where, you know, like slapstick, for instance. In the early days of Sesame Street, they had lots of it, and Henson reveled in slapstick. He loved when a monster would eat another monster, you know? But they got rid of slapstick because they kind of responded to letters from parents and who were complaining about it and suggesting that their child, because Don Music would bang his head on the keyboard because he was so frustrated, that their child would, of course, go run off and bang his head or her head on the keyboard, which never happens, or that their child would walk down a flight of stairs with 5 chocolate cream pies and fall to the sidewalk. You know, I think they were a little silly about that. And it may be that Sammy the Snake was excised for those same reasons.
I know that there have been sensitivities to people's letters and calls and concerns over the years. One of the most interesting stories in the book to me is the addition of the character of Zoe, who in some ways was charged with being a sort of standard bearer for feminists who were mad that there were no girl Muppets who were very prominent.
Yes, and she definitely was a response to that anger and frustration, but she also, and this was what almost did her in, she was created more by the marketing department than she was by the writers. Hmm. And it was a time when they wanted to get another Muppet character out there in the marketplace. And
the next Big Elmo.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not how you create a Muppet. Muppets always are a function of great writing and great performance. They evolve. They don't spring, you know, out of people's heads fully formed. It takes a while to kind of get your arms around the character, and, you know, and you try things. Like, the Count in the early days was much scarier than he is now. Now he's kind of a doting uncle of a vampire, but, you know, in the early days, he was really vampirish. And but they, you know, they changed and modified it. And now, you know, I love the Count. But I guess what I'm saying is that Zoe, right from the start, was a problem. And the only reason that she stayed on the show and became the character that she is right now, and I think a very good character, is because of the brilliance of Fran Brill, the performer who is behind Zoe. She's done such a great job with him. When you see that character, what you're seeing is a lot of Fran Brill's soul.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Bob in Dallas. Hello, Bob.
Hello. Hi. First, I want to say, I mean, I just love Sesame Street, and I think that characters on Sesame Street and the things that they did there really treated kids with respect, and I think some of those shows today kind of talk down to kids. You know, mm-hmm. the way they do things. And in fact, I always quote and talk about one of my favorite scenes was Bert was on trial. Bert was on trial and he for trespassing. And he brought in a sign that, and they said, you know, the trespasser. He says, no, no. And he brought in the sign. It says, the sign didn't have any punctuations. way he read it was, no trespassing, no fishing allowed. And that's one of the things I always remember. Of course, he was found not guilty for trespassing, but he was found guilty for stealing the sign.
Well, but Bob, you hit it right on the head, you know. Respect is the reason that the writers and producers respected their audience, even though they were kind of short. And a lot of children's television just doesn't do that. They don't respect the intelligence and the taste of children.
There was a sort of drop-off in the Sesame Street audience when Barney hit it big.
Yes.
Can you talk about the response to that?
Yes. And I hope I'm not insulting anyone out there in your listening audience who are Barney fans. I'm not one.
Well, they made the show really close to here.
Yes, I know that. Probably within shouting distance of this station. But, you know, Barney came about at a time when I don't know what the need was for children, but whatever the need was, Barney fulfilled it. The show had an incredible ability to tune into the emotional needs of very young preschool children. And the folks at Sesame Workshop were a little stunned by it. First of all, they'd always been king of the hill, and they really never had any competition in the field of preschool television. They always coexisted beautifully with Fred Rogers and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood because he wasn't about the brain so much as he was about the emotions and the soul. In fact, Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers together were very compatible. But here comes Barney, and it scared them. They didn't know how to respond to it. And I'll tell that story when we come back.
I love it when a guest leads into his own break, yes. Michael Davis is with us. He's a television critic whose new book is called Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. If you want to get on the line to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering flexible part-time graduate study. You can cultivate your curiosity at SMU and learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour to television critic Michael Davis, whose new book is called Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. And you were talking before the break, Michael, about the rise of Barney and what that did to the street.
Yeah, well, you know, because their stature was threatened and because Barney encroached on their ratings, they decided to modify the show to try to bring some of those little viewers back. And they lightened up the set and repainted it so that it was in brighter colors. And they created this million-dollar set called Around the Corner and populated it with a whole bunch of new characters. And then they also made a big decision to bring in professional actor children instead of inviting in sort of neighborhood children to populate the street. Because, you know, those were professional actors on Barney. And it was a disaster. Mm-hmm. Around the Corner was just the most wrong-headed thing Sesame Street ever did. And it only lasted for a few years, and thank goodness they reverted back to honoring the core characters, and they dissembled the set, the Around the Corner set, and really no one ever talks about it anymore. And I think they wish that they hadn't written about it in the book, as a matter of fact.
Another big change came when research started revealing that it wasn't five-year-olds and kids starting school that were watching the show most of the time. It was much younger children.
Yeah. I think what happened is that little Nielsen demographic that, you know, starts at age 2 and ends at age 5 was cleaved so that Sesame Street was being watched by 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds and maybe kids into the first half of their fourth year. And once they got to 4 or 5-year-old, they were finding the show to be, in quotes, too babyish. And they were migrating over to Nickelodeon and Disney Channel, where they were finding other shows to watch. So Sesame Street has had to modify its goals to reach a much younger audience, and Elmo fits perfectly into that strategy because he just has an uncanny sense of being able to communicate with the 2 and 3 year old. I'm sure you've seen this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Because children come out of the womb these days saying Elmo.
Well, and it seems like the show is very much focused on Elmo now.
Oh, it is. It's it's the Elmo-centric era of Sesame Street. And that's good and bad.
Was there jealousy among the other puppeteers?
Mm-hmm. I think there was.
Yeah.
It took a lot of getting used to. Sonia Monsano, who has played Maria since the very early 1970s, said, I never thought anyone could supplant the bird.
It happened. She's extraordinary because she looks and sounds, it seems to me, exactly as she did 35 years ago.
She has made a deal with the devil because her skin is beautiful. She's absolutely gorgeous, and she hasn't aged a day.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Nancy in Dallas. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I love this show, and I loved Sesame Street. I'm more than 50, so when it was in its early days, I was in high school, but I would get up early enough every morning that I watched Sesame Street before I went to high school. I wouldn't have admitted it, but I did. And I grew up to be, I'm a professional ventriloquist and puppeteer, and I learned everything that I needed to know about those different levels, about just like what Michael was talking about something for the children and something for the older people, and also the fact that the puppet is not, it doesn't come fully formed. It doesn't matter how beautiful the puppet is, it has to have a soul. Mm-hmm. And I thank Sesame Street for those things. But I have a short remembrance. My son, who is now 28, his favorite segment was, I'm a dog, I'm a working dog, I'm a hard working dog. Mm-hmm. And it showed this border collie rounding up the sheep. Well, when Brody lost his first dog, when Petey was run over by the cattle truck, and we had our little doggy funeral out in the yard, there stood my son Brody, 5 years old, and he was singing, I'm a dog, I'm a working dog, I'm a hard working dog. So I guess Sesame Street has definitely touched 2 generations of our family.
That's a great story. Nancy, thanks so much for calling.
You're welcome.
That might be the story that you were telling us that we would definitely have, Michael.
Oh, yeah. People visit my website, which is streetgangbook.com, and there's a very easy mechanism to leave me stories, and some of them are just so poignant, and some of them are so sad, and some of them are hilarious. Somebody wrote me recently and said, you know, when my mom talked to me about Santa Claus, I accepted it, but the day that I learned Kermit was a puppet, I was unconsolably sad.
Let's go next to Anne in Hearst. Hey, Anne.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Sure.
I cannot tell you how I was coming home from work today and turned this on, and it was like a flood of warm fuzzies just hit me, hearing everybody singing and recalling their memories. And I have to say, it's so exciting. I'm super psyched that there are other people out there besides me as an adult who remembers these feelings. When I was, 2, there was a segment on Sesame Street, and it was a daisy that was blooming in the rain, and it was to Vivaldi concert in D, which was, usually you hear Vivaldi and you think, okay, Four Seasons, but this was kind of more of a random, less known strain, and my mom came in and found me just crying as a toddler, and that was when I first realized that music was able to move you in such a way, and to this day, I feel like I'm in a constant pursuit of trying to remember that wonderful feeling of how it felt to sit in front of that TV, hear the music, see that image, and it was almost a mental hug from Sesame Street.
Wow.
And from this day on, I can still remember, I heard the working dog, and that made me want to tear up because I remember that, and it was just a very magical time to be able to see the early Sesame Streets. And I guess later on in my young adulthood, I suffered a very serious episode with depression. And in the mornings, I would wake up and turn on Sesame Street. And, that was the best antidepressant ever. It brought me back to life. And I'm so grateful for that. And to this day, when I hear It's Not Easy Being Green or Sing a Song, it warms my heart.
Anne, thank you so much for calling.
It's a wonderful thing, so thank you.
Thank you. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email us to think@kera.org. Do you ever find, Michael, that people remember things that were not from Sesame Street?
Yes. Yes, they always want to put Miss Piggy in there. And, of course, Miss Piggy was only part of the Muppet Show and then the subsequent Muppet movies. But I think more times than not, though, people tell me stories just like the one we heard where there was a single segment, whether it was a live-action film or an animation or a Bert and Ernie skit or whatever it is that they took with them for the rest of their lives, that just stayed with them.
There are some people who theorize that my generation, Generation X, and certainly the one to follow, the reason that our attention spans are not what our parents were is because we grew up on Sesame Street.
I love your generation. I don't know what people are talking about. I think your generation has been responsible for some of the freshest ideas and the coolest things in media, and I don't know what people are talking about. I just think that, contrary to what those people say, look at look at CGI animation. You know, look at the iPod. Look at all of this incredible stuff that has come about. This is a golden age, and I think Sesame Street is responsible for helping bring a lot of these things along.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Adam in Arlington. Hey, Adam.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Chris.
Sure.
A few years ago, a friend of mine posed the question to me, asked me what the first hip-hop I ever saw was. I thought about it for a second and rattled off the name of some band, and he corrected me and informed me that it was actually Sesame Street, because they're, you know, hanging out on the corner and making little rhymes and hanging out with crazy characters. And I was just wondering if your guests had heard anything like that before.
I've heard it many times. And one point that we haven't made in this hour is that Sesame Street is so responsible for exposing children to the greater culture, to great musicians, poets, actors. I mean, the list of guest appearances on Sesame Street constitutes the greatest alumni association in show business. It's Johnny Cash, it's Ray Charles, it's Yo-Yo Ma, it's Itzhak Perlman. It's amazing. Maya Angelou. You could go on all day and talking about the wonderful artists who made appearances on Sesame Street. I'll tell you a quick story. I interviewed James Taylor for the book, and he told me that he believes in his heart that he would not have had a second and third generation of fan base had it not been for his appearances on Sesame Street,
wow,
where he sang Up on a Roof and he sang Whenever I See Your Grouchy Face to Oscar. And he also did a song called Jellyman Kelly. Some of your listeners may remember this. And when he's out on tour in the summer, invariably people yell out, play Jellyman Kelly. And sometimes he does.
Why did Snuffleupagus go from being invisible to anyone but Big Bird to being...
There's a good reason. You know, you remember that time in our cultural history when, you know, the kids started showing up on milk cartons and terrible things were reported in the news about what was happening at daycare centers.
Yeah.
It really caused the writers and producers at Sesame Street to think, are we doing the right thing by having a situation where Big Bird is trying to tell them that Snuffleupagus is real and they're not believing him?
Because he was always telling the truth.
He was always telling the truth. Snuffy was visible. We saw him, and he wasn't an invisible friend. That's when they decided that they really need to find a way to make him visible to everyone on Sesame Street. And I think they did it brilliantly with an episode involving Phil Donahue, who came on and did a mock Phil Donahue show exposing to all the viewers that there indeed was a Snuffleupagus.
It really is extraordinary how flexible they've been. And I'm wondering if there have been some staff members over the years who just couldn't adjust to that rate of change.
I'm sure that that's true. I think they lost more staff members, though, to the fact that there wasn't as much work to keep a lot of really great people satisfied. And what happened was that they went off and they started their own production companies, or they went to Nick, or they went to Disney Channel, because so many of the gatekeepers in children's television had a term of service at Sesame Workshop. It's like the graduate school for preschool television.
Yeah, because they now do 13 episodes a year, and it used to be, what, 10 times that?
Yeah, 10 times that, 130. And, you know, that's a matter of expense, but it's also a matter of a decision that was made at Sesame Workshop to really concentrate on spreading the gospel, if you will, of Sesame Street across the globe, that they're all about the internationalization of Sesame Street these days.
So I have to ask you this, Michael. You've written about children's television for much of your career. Is it hard now to look at any other show and find anything comparable?
Well, I will say this to you. I really do believe that this is the best era ever for children's television overall, and especially preschool television. I love some things that I see on Nick, a show called Wonder Pets, which has an operetta built into every episode. I love a lot of the stuff on Disney Channel and Discovery Kids. So I think the competition is good, but I also think that that Sesame Street remains the gold standard, and the reason is research. The reason is that there's a lot of money there to keep probing and asking what children need, and the show stays alive because it renews itself each season. They don't stand still. They keep pushing forward. You know, that old line about, you know, you either grow or die? They're continuing to grow at age 40, which is great news for us.
Do you have a very favorite segment? I'm sure this is a question that you get asked every time.
Do I have a favorite segment? Yeah, it's one that probably isn't all that known to most people. When John Stone died, it took them a long time to figure out how to honor him on the show. And they came up with an episode where the street sign for Sesame Street goes missing. Hmm. And A lot of the Muppet characters are upset, but of course the one who's upset most of all is Telly, who's neurotic, and he begins to fear that no one will ever come to Sesame Street anymore because they won't be able to find it. And that was a metaphor for John Stone, and he was soothed at the end of the episode to know that people would always find Sesame Street, that you don't need a street sign to find it. Beautiful episode.
Great story. The new book by Michael Davis is called Street Gang, The Complete History of Sesame Street. Michael, it has been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for letting me speak to people in Texas. What a thrill. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.